Well, John Sweeney, the editor-in-chief of Paraclete Press, want to thank you for joining us. Maybe, John, you can just introduce your work at Paraclete, what kind of books you edit and the work you're involved in there.
Sure. Paraclete Press is located on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. We've been around for about 30 years, and I've been with the press for about 9. Paraclete is an interesting place. It's a ecumenical Christian publisher. People often say to me, you are a Catholic press, aren't you? And I usually joke and say, no, but we don't mind you thinking that we are. We publish a lot of Catholic books, a lot of Catholic subjects, but we also publish a fair amount in Eastern Orthodoxy, occasional mainline Protestant and evangelical books, and some Jewish authors from time to time, too. So we cover a pretty wide spectrum, but we tend to focus on spirituality, classics, spiritual practices, books for moments of liturgy or key moments in the life of a Christian in the church. We tend to stay away from heavier theology. We tend to stay away from issues kinds of books. So our reputation is for beautiful spirituality that runs across the gamut of all different Christian traditions.
Yeah, I think you sent along a book to us recently about praying with Emily Dickinson. So that's one title, for example.
Yeah, that's right. We do what I think of as sort of literary spiritual stuff, and we do that very well. Paraclete Press is actually owned by a religious community. It's called the Community of Jesus. They've been around for 50 or 60 years, and it's one of those sort of uniquely, mostly American kind of places, neo-monastic. So it's a community that is organized in the Benedictine tradition, and there are Catholics there, and there are Protestants there, Christians of various backgrounds, but they worship and live together. And everyone who works at Paraclete Press other than me is a member of that community. So anyway, that's a long way of saying that the community, being Benedictine and as such, it values beauty very highly. So we try and bring beauty into the world in a whole lot of ways, including the subjects that we publish, the authors that we look for, and then the packaging and the way in which we publish. So that just makes us a little bit different from other publishers where it might be that content is 99% of what they're about. For us, I'd say content is 90% of what we're about and beauty the other. So for that reason, we do a lot of poetry. We do some sort of lovely packaging and different kinds of things. But Flannery O'Connor, Emily Dickinson, we like those kinds of subjects.
So it was as the editor-in-chief of Paraclete Press, you attended the London Book Fair, and that's the occasion of your latest piece for America, looking at the state of the book industry. You make some interesting points there about how the world of publishing has developed, the development of Kindle singles, you know, obviously publishing online. It seems like that's a plus and minus for writers. For writers who already have an established reputation, that can be a great boon, but for struggling writers, maybe not so much.
Well, I think self-publishing, the most important point, I think, is to say that self-publishing no longer has a stigma. You know, I mean, it was only a decade ago, probably, that self-publishing had a stigma. You know, we called it vanity publishing. It was something that you only did if you weren't talented enough to get into print, you know. And the language has completely changed, and the paradigm has now changed. So now we see terrifically successful self-publishing, and then we see traditional publishers chasing after those people to bring them into the traditional publishing fold because they're getting left behind. So in some ways, it's a great opportunity for authors because there's no longer that stigma attached to it, and it is so easy to do now. It's so accessible. It has become a bit of a boon to editors, for instance. I have friends who do a lot of freelance editing, and they get hired by authors all the time. If you're a good copy editor today, you're in high demand because people are self-publishing so much, but they still need, you know, a good copy edit. They still need a good critical eye, and they're not getting that from a publishing house necessarily. But then for publishers, it puts us in a bind, in an interesting spot, because we have had over the last few years to try and figure out how much are we going to focus on the digital revolution and getting ebooks out and in terms of the backlist and converting everything electronically and digitally. how much are we going to focus on things like apps? How much are we going to focus on enhanced books, which cost a lot to produce? And then are we going to continue to focus on the physical book that you hold in your hand? And how are the audiences changing for all of those different kinds of products? So that is some of the stuff that publishers have to think about every day, and that's some of what I was reflecting on in the essay.
Yeah, I mean, do religious publishers, they're facing many of the same issues, obviously, as mainstream publishers, but at least in the case of, for example, magazine publishing, since we have a niche product, we still have a loyal readership, we have a little more time to maybe catch up with some of these trends, whereas a Time or a Newsweek, you know, they're really struggling. I mean, is it similar in the world of religious publishing? Is the niche market help at least a little bit?
Yeah, it does. It has made it all quite a bit slower of a transition. We still, I think, feel like we've been scrambling, but haven't been scrambling like, general trade fiction publishers, for instance. There was a statistic that came out a month ago from the Association of American Publishers, and it said that 23% of the market now, in terms of dollars, is ebooks. 23%. Which is a pretty startling number, particularly if you work in religion and spirituality publishing as I do, because the number's not nearly that high. I don't really know any publishers who are sort of akin to what Pericles Press does, who are higher than about 5 or 6%, ebooks, about 5 or 6%. That's in dollars, not in units. It's higher in units, of course, because ebooks are cheaper. So the transition has been slower for sure. If you're publishing Stephen King and John Grisham and best-selling fiction, then you've been scrambling quite a bit more than religion publishers have.
Now, one of the points you make, and I think it's very worthwhile, is that what is going to happen? We don't devote the resources to authors, give them the time to write. You know, somebody like Robert Caro to produce that multi-leg biography of Lyndon Johnson. That's potentially what we're going to lose here if there's not a business model that supports that kind of writing.
It's true. I think both that kind of writing and book selling itself has to find new ways of funding. I think of, on the bookseller side, for instance, there's so many bookstores that are gone compared to a decade ago, and there are some organizations that are starting to understand that a bookstore can't necessarily follow the same business model as another type of business, because the margins are very slight and because books by nature are mission related, at least when you're dealing in the field of religion and spirituality. And similarly, religion, spirituality, or scholarship, which is the example that you brought up, there's no way to produce that kind of writing that takes time unless you have some other kind of support. So, for instance, ever since books were printed, centuries ago, most writers, the vast majority of writers have had to have another occupation in order to pay the rent. And that's certainly not changing anytime soon. And it's getting even more dramatic. So, yeah, there's this growing gulf. There's two types of books that are dominating the marketplace today. There is the established brand author who, when he or she brings out his or her next book, they have a built-in audience. And increasingly, those authors don't even particularly need traditional publishers, or more and more they are trying to decide whether or not they need traditional publishers because their audience is already well-defined and already follows them on Twitter. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there are the thousands of books that are self-published direct to digital formats every single day. And how you can, find your way to the ones that are of interest to you and important to you is a big question today. But in between those two extremes is the majority of publishing that still happens. And we're all trying to figure out how to find our way.
Right. It seems to me, in the world of magazines as well as books, there needs to be a role for some sort of curator, somebody who's going to vet material for the, for the public. That you need somebody in the middle there to kind of determine to edit. But that role may be I don't know, less important, or the market may not reward that behavior.
Well, and I think the primary source of that curation in books these days is Amazon recommends,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, there are very few people who have not bought a book at some point from Amazon, and then Amazon, you know, has the ability to recommend similar titles that you might appreciate, and that is replacing in many ways what the traditional bookstore has done. But it doesn't quite, you know, fill the gap. We have half the number of bookstores today as we did a decade ago, and its discoverability is the big thing that we have lost. We, meaning publishers, don't yet know how to replace discoverability of a book that we used to achieve by simply getting it out into the bookstores. The bookstores did the majority of our marketing for us, and we never realized that as acutely as we do now.
Now, the London Book Fair, maybe you can just kind of describe it to our listeners who may not be familiar with it. What goes on there? Why did you go? What was going on this year?
Well, it happens every year. It happens in the spring. It is what is traditionally called a rights fair for the most part. So publishers go for the primary purpose of talking with other publishers from other countries and territories around the world to try and sell their wares so that those books will be translated or imported into those other countries or other territories, which is very similar to what happens at the Frankfurt Book Fair, which is the larger of the two. And your listeners and readers have probably heard of Frankfurt as a international rights publishing fair more than they've heard of London. But each of them happens once a year, and London was started years ago in the spring because Frankfurt always happens in the fall. So that's the idea. I don't go every year. I go probably every other year, and I go to Frankfurt probably every other year as well. But it is where we meet with publishers from Russia and from China and from India and from Great Britain and so on, and exchange our lists of what's forthcoming and talk about, you know, ways in which we might either cooperate or just simply import or translate each other's work.
Well, that raises an interesting question. I mean, in terms of translating works, having access to literature from other countries, is there more, you know, in this globalized world with Amazon, do readers in the United States have more access to these works these days than perhaps they did 10 years ago?
They do. It has made the rights side of publishing and the income that comes from rights, it has made all of that a little more complicated, because in many ways it's not quite as a sense of urgency to go out and seek that as a separate source of income, because it tends to find its way. For those who are really interested in the book, they're going to be able to find their way to purchasing the copy that already exists in a British edition, for instance, or in a Canadian edition, rather than having to wait for the American edition. I mean, I do that myself. I mean, you might as well. You know, a book is published in England, and it still seems ridiculous that we wait 6 or 9 months for that same book to be published over here. And I have been known to go ahead and order the copy that I want from England rather than wait. And there will come a day sooner and sooner when we see less and less of that kind of anything short of simultaneous publishing.
Well, finally, maybe we could just talk a bit about, you know, the culture of books, the culture of reading. In some ways, devices like the Kindle, like the Nook, you would think might, because it's so easy to access literature, you can download things in 60 seconds, you can have hundreds of books on your device, that might help feed this culture. On the other hand, it causes these other market problems. So is there any hope that these devices can bring us in new directions or create a different culture?
Well, this is the point in this kind of a conversation where I start feeling like a Luddite. Because I'm not even that old. I mean, I'm about to turn 46, but I've been in publishing my whole life. So I feel like an old man when I talk about this sort of thing. I don't see how to replace the object myself fully. I have great appreciation for digital publishing and things like the Kindle and its ability to hold a bunch of titles, particularly, you know, when you're traveling or when you need to refer to them simply for research or to read the newspaper or, you know, some of those kinds of things. But my concern is attention span. I mean, my concern is that I think something will change, is changing in the way that our brains actually work and our ability to focus and concentrate and sit still for more than 10 minutes without following a link to something else. All of those things concern me a lot as someone who loves books. And I'm willing to love books in multiple formats. It's just that I think that it is easier to concentrate and focus and keep your attention on something for more than 10 minutes. It is easier to do that, I think, when something is being held in your hand, at least for now. So I would love to see us hold on to those values as we make these transitions and find ways to not lose them in the transition.
No, I think that's a good point. I mean, I love my Kindle, but I share some of the concerns that, you know, they're going to come a time where the only thing available is something like a tablet or a Kindle Fire where you can read your book or you can watch Netflix. And that's right. Where the culture of distraction really, it's very tempting to turn, you know, stop reading and do something else.
Right. Well, and I hope that I just said all of that in a way that's not snobbish, because there's a way to say it that sounds snobbish, which is, you know, and so in other words, I'm not saying that I think, you know, the Kindle or the digital book has cheapened books or publishing. I think that's silly. I mean, in the 16th century, that's what snobs were saying about the printing press. And, you know, in the first half of the 20th century, that's what snobs were saying about paperbacks. You know, they were going to cheapen books. And then for years, people have said that about audiobooks. I mean, how many times have you been at a party or at dinner with someone and they've said, and you say, you know, what are you reading these days? And they say, oh, well, I'm reading Dostoevsky, and I listen to it in the car. And then someone else around the table says, well, you didn't really read it. You know, you're just listening to it. So, I mean, I'm not a fan of any of that kind of snobbery. I'm just talking about those other sort of values. I want personally, and I would like my children, and I would like my friends and my congregation and my community, I would like everyone to be able to concentrate, you know, for a certain length of time and to be able to read the kind of writing and the kinds of books that require sustained concentration. And I find it hard, as you said, to do it other than in something in my hand. You know, I find that I read best when I'm sitting on an airplane, and for the next 2 or 3 hours, I don't have a choice. Well, because I'm not going to pay the $30 or whatever to, you know, to get the Wi-Fi. So the only choice I have is to pull out a physical book.
Well, it's interesting. We have found that the Kindle is very popular with some of our older readers, which was kind of a surprise. But I think they grew up in a culture where they learned how to read for long periods of time. So they're true readers, and they like the convenience of the device. But are we creating that next generation of readers? I don't know about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there are studies recently that have shown that kids in college today prefer physical textbooks still, which I find fascinating. But when people ask me the question which usually comes up, which is what do you think about the future for the physical book? How long will they be around? My response usually is that they'll be around as long as baby boomers are active, because I think baby boomers will continue to purchase physical books, and we probably have another 10 or 15 years while baby boomers are still actively doing a lot of that. So I think of the slide from physical book to digital and so on, I think of that as being a slow slide for the next 10 or 15 years. But then after that point, it's all up for grabs. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, maybe we'll talk to you in 10 years and see where things stand.
I'm sure I'll sound just as confused then as I do now.
Well, John Sweeney, thanks very much.
Sure, my pleasure.